This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Gentlemen, we're here to discuss a timeless piece that turns 10 years old this week. Speculative Attack. Pierre, how does it feel to know that this piece is now officially 10 years old?
Yeah, on a personal level, it makes me feel old. But at the same time, I did write it when I was young. It feels timeless still. It reminds me of a classical song, Bolero, that has this very, very long buildup of just the same thing over and over, but louder and louder. So I think that's kind of been the pattern. When I wrote it, I thought that speculative attacks would happen much sooner, much faster. And I think that, you know, what I really didn't understand was how much people would rebalance their portfolios. There's lots of sell pressure on Bitcoin when the price goes up, which we don't like to hear as Bitcoin maxis, but that's just the reality. Excited to be here and to be recognizing the 10-year anniversary.
Well, it is, again, a timeless piece and one of the first I share with people. When they ask, why should I not take out a mortgage and buy a house? Why should I buy Bitcoin? And I literally sent this to somebody 3 months ago, when I was back in Philly, and he was like, yeah, I gotta go buy a house and I'm going to go to an 8% mortgage. And I was like, maybe you should read this piece. But as you mentioned, the speculative attack has not happened as quickly as you may have expected when we were all younger. However, it has sort of, I don't want to say evolved, but there are new ways in which the speculative attack is materializing, new ways to short the dollar. And so how has the landscape of Bitcoin adoption, particularly by nation states and now large corporations, affected your view on how this speculative attack may play out in the long run?
Yeah, I'd emphasize, though, that speculative attacks have been happening continuously. And so it really is a question of, is there some kind of final one where Bitcoin finally causes the dollar to hyperinflate? But I think that's a bigger question. But when we look at how people actually use Bitcoin day to day in terms of a long-term saving vehicle, speculative attacks have been happening continuously in that people have been leveraged versus the dollar and then have deleveraged themselves. You know, you'll hear stories about, oh, I paid off my parents' mortgage by using Bitcoin, right? And so the gains from Bitcoin have certainly had the same dynamic that we see in a classic speculative attack that was initially described by Paul Krugman when he was looking at the Asian financial crisis in the 90s. I'm sorry, what was the question again?
The ways in which the manifestation of speculative attack has materialized, like the mechanics, like MicroStrategy coming to market, El Salvador with their volcano bonds.
Right. And so in the piece 10 years ago, I kind of illustrated it with an illustration that comes from the classic look at, okay, people are creating the weak currency by borrowing it through the commercial banking system, and that then they are using that weak currency to trade for the strong currency and then waiting for it to appreciate. And it's a reflexive feedback loop because by creating more weak currency, they are causing its devaluation. And then repaying that loan with the strong currency that has strengthened. So that is kind of the classic illustration of a speculative attack, but it's just an illustrative example. There's actually lots of different mechanisms by which you can have the same economic effect. I'll let Alan speak further to that. He did an excellent job digging into some further examples.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So actually, just before I do that, I want to pick up on the very first comment that both of you guys made, that this makes me feel really old. Like, I can't even imagine what it's like for Pierre. I remember reading this probably not quite 10 years ago, but I want to say like 2015 at the latest or something. And I thought of the following kind of amusing way of putting it, that this article is older than my career, which is now about what this article is about, basically. But yeah, it's, I think the proper, and obviously Pierre's not going to say this himself, so I now need to embarrass him, but the proper reaction to this is to just congratulate him on having the unbelievable foresight and prescience even to have predicted that something like this was possible in 2014. I would, maybe at the end, we can come back to Pierre's reflections on, I don't know, I don't want to put him too much on the spot, but something like, how serious were you even when you wrote this? Because it now seems obvious, but I don't think it was obvious that, like, I don't remember reading this 9 or 10 years ago. As in, I remember that I did read it, but I don't remember the exact experience of reading it. I'm not sure I would have taken it all that seriously. I think it would have been more like, huh, this is quite funny. Like, maybe one day this could happen. I don't know.
I was completely different. I read it, I'm like left side of the bell curve. I was like, this is how it's going to happen. This is obvious.
Is probably happening right now. No, anyway, sorry. I don't want to, I just want to make sure that we mention that. I'm sure Pierre hears this all the time. So maybe the 10 year anniversary is a good time to bring this up again. Like, well done for having written this at all. But anyway, yeah, sorry, you're asking, the speculative attack has now broadened, right? There are many more avenues to do it. And this is what we dig into in the newer piece, which is really just celebrating the anniversary as much as anything else. I think that you can go through individual examples, like Marty, you mentioned MicroStrategy already. I think El Salvador is a super obvious one. I think there will also be, this will be good to get into in a minute, this coming bull cycle, there will be even more interesting ones that actually return to what individuals can participate in. Because obviously, I guess you could buy MicroStrategy stock, but then that's not really the same thing as what MicroStrategy itself is doing, or like similarly, you know, buy El Salvador bonds and do really, really well for, you know, as far as emerging market bonds go. But avenues that individuals can directly participate in, other than obviously just borrowing fiat, kind of even more sly roundabout ways, that'll be fun. But I think what underpins all of these, though, is the realization that fiat is such, you know, the fiat banking system is such that it creates involuntary dollar shorts everywhere, right? I tease that out a little bit more. People might not completely appreciate what I mean by that. Everybody is kind of speculatively attacking the dollar anyway, because they have to, because it's just insane to save with it. So, and Pierre pointed this out in the first article, that, you know, if you basically want to acquire any kind of assets, ignoring Bitcoin for, you know, the purposes of this analysis, it is arguably prudent to go short the dollar. Or go short fiat, any other even weaker fiat, is it becomes even more prudent. And so what we're observing here, though, is that almost any other supposedly hard asset that you could, you know, you could make your long, whereas fiat is your short, will have two problems relative to Bitcoin. The more obvious one, I guess, is that no matter what it is, it's just not as scarce, right? Its equities are nowhere near scarce, real estate, whatever, even gold. And this is like classic Bitcoin lore. You know, we don't need to explain that in too much more detail. But the more interesting one, though, is realizing also in the meantime, since Pierre wrote the first article, just how much worse fiat has gotten just how much of a monetary premium it's pushed into just about every other one of these assets, which I think it's fair to interpret as a result of people speculatively attacking the dollar, even if they don't, you know, think of what they're doing that way. They think of what they're doing as saving, basically, because you can't save with fiat. That monetary premium is now also being attacked by Bitcoin. So it's not just that Bitcoin is better, it's that it's reasonable to expect a kind of reflexivity in the monetary premium shifting. And so that's what's now super exciting, that it's not just that the fundamentals of Bitcoin, or however you want to, you know, pitch the case for going long Bitcoin, it's not just that they're better, it's that the circumstances of the short are arguably better as well, right? As well as the long in Bitcoin, the fragility of all the involuntary dollar shorts is now even more enticing than it was 10 years ago.
Well, oh, go ahead, Pierre.
Oh, I was just gonna respond to the point about how serious I was about it. Oh, yeah. My state of mind going into it was really about what is the adoption mechanism for Bitcoin? Because there were lots of people who said that, hey, this really is about credit card fees. And so the way that we'll see adoption play out for Bitcoin is that merchants don't want to pay 3% in credit card fees to, fiat payment mechanisms, and that we'll see Bitcoin gradually be adopted. And then finally, you know, nobody will use dollars because dollars are too expensive to use. And so I wanted to look at the monetary economics research, or, you know, school, not a school of thought, but a kind of how do monies dominate each other and how do they take market share? And it's really not about the cost of making coffee payments. It really is about the strength of their monetary policy and the relative strength of it. And so it certainly was a very serious look at it and belief in that it is the truth. It was in response to other theories that were floating around about what would be the driver of Bitcoin adoption.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. And you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and their rolling out a bunch of other products, including an inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com. I think it's pretty incredible that we're at the 10-year anniversary of this piece. And you guys mentioned in the piece that we're in season 2 of the speculative attack, and the timing couldn't be more perfect. I mean, literally last week, the interest expense on the debt surpassed the amount that we're paying on defense spending here in the U.S. At the same time, you've had the weaponization of the treasury market over the last couple of years, which has forced many countries to seriously think about diversifying away from U.S. treasuries as a reserve asset. You have Japan losing control of their yield curve, and they're the largest holder of U.S. treasuries. And that is really what gives the dollar the reserve status, the reserve currency status of the world, is the fact that you have so much demand for our debt. And as we turn the chapter into chapter 2, it seems like that demand is waning pretty materially, which could accelerate things. Does anybody want to hop in here?
Yes, I completely agree.
And so I think
that's another interpretation that I didn't even come to. I didn't want to, you know, list everything that possibly came to mind, but as to why the short is also deteriorating, or well, from the Bitcoiner's perspective or the speculative attacker's perspective, it's improving, right? And I think that's maybe the more interesting thing that is what we're trying to draw attention to in the new piece, is what I think is so impressive about the old piece. But also, I think most of all, especially, you know, if your starting point is just like Bitcoin Twitter, where its number go up all day long, which I approve of for the most part, but, you know, as a meme, right? Not less so as kind of serious analysis. I think there's space for much more serious analysis on the short side. I think it's almost more intellectually interesting in a way. It's kind of scary in a way too, because you start realizing just how much is likely to implode, I guess, you know, which is another way of saying how many avenues there are for now speculatively attacking rather than just borrowing fiat. Again, is realizing that there is so much borrowed fiat that's just, you know, doesn't realize yet that it's looking for Bitcoin. It'll find Bitcoin. And that's I think by comparison, that's far more straightforward in terms of how that plays out. What's scary, interesting, uncertain, I guess. More worthy of analysis, I think, is, well, what happens to all these shorts? I frankly have no idea. I mean, I can speculate on it, but I think that's the essence of the speculative attack. The number go up part is fine. Like that'll take care of itself. It's what happens to everything else.
Well, I mean, look at the world right now. The U.S. real estate market. You have mortgage rates around 7-8%, all-time high prices. Maybe it's leveling out. And then look over to equities. It seems like NVIDIA is the one stock holding up the U.S. financial system and arguably the global financial system. People are looking with bated breath to see if NVIDIA rolls over and what that does for
people. Are you suggesting that valuation is not justified?
What is it? It's like a 49.
Don't you believe in AI, Marty? What? Come on.
Well, I mean, it's indicative of, it feels like, I guess this is the question, is how can the speculative attack, how much education, education around Bitcoin is needed to accelerate this? Like people's understanding of Bitcoin, obviously, we understand it very well, and that's why we're here talking about this. You wrote this piece 10 years ago, but just looking post-COVID, the explosion of flows into equities, housing, treasuries even to some extent, or hard assets like gold as opposed to treasuries, and Bitcoin, we're sitting at $61,000 right now. Many people think it should be higher. Is there a catalyst, whether it be in equities, in the housing market, where people sort of wake up and they're like, holy crap, this is not the store value that I thought it was? And what will it take in terms of information around Bitcoin, knowledge around Bitcoin to drive those flows into Bitcoin? And what is like the aha moment that pushes everybody towards Bitcoin?
Yeah, I'd say that first it's a momentum play. So they don't really need any education beyond just looking at the price chart. And I think that the financial press has done a great job of educating people about Bitcoin's price, which sounds weird, but they're constantly showing charts. I think the ETFs help with that as well. So now you can very easily see how Bitcoin's performing relative to other assets. So that's where it starts. Then the real education challenge comes from when they want to rebalance, right? Of, okay, well, I looked at Bitcoin's chart, it went up, I made money, so now I'm going to sell and I'm going to convert back into dollars. And that, I think, is really where the education is critical of, you're going back onto the Titanic, right? You're actually... you don't understand what you're selling. So understanding that there's intrinsic value to holding your own keys, to running your own node, I think that education, it's not so much helping people to understand why they should buy Bitcoin, but really helping them understand why they shouldn't sell Bitcoin and why there's no second best, why there is no alternative. That is the education piece that it's not just needed today, but I think it'll be needed forever, in that future generations will constantly have to relearn why Bitcoin has value, you know, beyond just its purchasing power. Because if they only understand the purchasing power, then they go out and spend it. If they understand why you want to hold it, that's, I think, takes education and will take education forever. And, you know, that's why I'm excited about what Michael Goldstein, Bitstein, is doing with the Nakamoto Institute and many others, including this podcast, are doing to help on that education front.
Yeah. Also, not to in any way knock what we all obviously mean by education, but I think that probably the best education on this front is just going to be getting wrecked, right? Selling out Bitcoin because, as Pierre says, you know, you've seen the number go up, you like the chart, you want to rebalance. You don't realize what Bitcoin really is. You think it's just, you know, yet another financial asset that's done well within your portfolio or whatever. And essentially, this is an interesting way of putting it, actually, that in that position, you maybe haven't really realize that you are speculatively attacking in the first place. Because if you understand that, so this is going back not only to Pierre's original article, but, you know, the concept that he was borrowing just in FX and in general, you don't stop a speculative attack. You don't sell out. Like, you don't think to yourself, okay, cool, I've made enough money now. You do it in the first place because you realize the currency is completely going to shit. So if people... I think the ETFs play into this massively. There's a good side and a bad side to that entirely in general, but even restricted to this, that it obviously makes it a lot easier to buy, but the other side of that coin, I think, is that people will, a lot of that buying almost by definition wouldn't have otherwise, but not just for the structural reasons, also for exactly these educational reasons, right? So there will have been insufficient education behind the initial purchase, and then the real education will be when they eventually realize that they screwed up their speculative attack, right? They could have followed it through, but they didn't. They rebalanced instead. Hopefully then they seek some, you know, real education. Then they can find the original article. They can find everything else from the Nakamoto Institute. But I think getting wrecked is probably going to be the most important first step for a lot of people.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on our risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off.
What are the lowest hanging fruit alternatives to rebalancing for individuals who are thinking about it? Really comes down to managing your cost and making sure that you can hold Bitcoin. I've seen number one.
Yeah, so I alluded to this earlier. I'm glad that we were able to get onto it, that one of the things that's exciting me the most, I don't know exactly what time horizon I expect this to play out over. I think it will become more popular in the next, let's say, 3 to 4 years, you know, this cycle. It'll become a lot more normalized. Is, and again, I think this is also yet another way of widening the avenues to speculatively attack significantly more purposefully than what I just described with somebody buying an ETF, let's say, is the model, which I think is probably fairly credited to Unchained, at least at first, of the over-collateralized loan and all the, you know, nice assurances that both parties get with that. I'm increasingly seeing, I'm sure probably both of you are as well, increasingly seeing ways of basically generalizing that model to different kinds of fiat payments, such that anybody who holds Bitcoin will, I think, increasingly easily be able to find, let's say, trustworthy enough counterparties to do something similar to, well, it will be an over-collateralized loan, but may not necessarily feel that way. So two points I want to make there. So one is that I realized as I was saying it, right, in terms of like trusted counterparties and so on, this is very much not, you know, DeFi. That's not what I'm promoting here at all. It's impossible to do DeFi with fiat because it's centralized. So you need to have some trust, ideally more in the mechanism, and the Bitcoin side of it can be, you know, as transparent as everybody is willing to allow, but you will need to trust some or other counterparty for this to even be possible in the first place. The second, though, is that I don't mean not all to be like throwing Unchained under the bus. I mean, they may well end up being involved in exactly the kind of thing I'm describing, but at least the initial model that they had, I think people conceive of that as being for big purchases, basically. And I don't know if that's a question of like how it was marketed or just the size of the loan that was necessary to make it economical to bootstrap this model. But, you know, it could be for like a down payment on a house or something. Or I think Pierre even mentioned that before, right? That, you know, people realizing Bitcoin gains to pay off their mortgage or something to that effect, or a car or whatever, you know, something big. But what I'm excited about is generalizing this to enable things like credit cards, where the custodian of the Bitcoin is basically basically acting as an issuing bank, and are giving you, rather than one big loan, they're issuing you a revolving line of credit in exactly the same way that credit cards work with fiat banks, as people just don't really think about it that much because they kind of imagine it as one-off payments, but which also provides this avenue of attack. Because again, this is going back to something that Pierre mentioned in the first article, that and that we, you know, we do our best to pick up on in the more recent one, that if you're ever deciding not to buy Bitcoin, you're effectively leveraged, right? Whether you conceive of it that way or not, this is, you know, this is itself presents an obvious avenue for carrying out like a micro speculative attack, right? I think the only, this definitely was significantly harder to actually execute 10 years ago, but this is exactly what I'm now excited about. I think it's going to become easier and easier because so much infrastructure has been built in the meantime to enable people to effectively be borrowing against Bitcoin to spend dollars or spend fiat. Not even necessarily because, you know, they want to, like, they won't even need to think of it as a speculative attack, right? They won't be doing it. They could if they wanted to, but I think what's really cool about it is they don't need to. It just, if anything, this is kind of the, what's so nice about the entire theory is that at a certain point, it just becomes rational to do this. You don't even really need to be able to articulate why, like the financial ins and outs, or, you know, explain your own personal financial decision-making in terms of longs and shorts in a portfolio and all that. It's just obviously rational to not spend Bitcoin, to borrow dollars, and to create this position, and, you know, in doing so, contribute to the overall speculative attack by just kind of chipping away at the edges.
Well, so I think that in terms of helping people not rebalance, one way to do it is to just make it really inconvenient to spend your Bitcoin. So put it into a multi-sig that's in several different locations, and maybe even have one of the keys be with your maxi friend who will make fun of you for selling your Bitcoin. So that's one. The other is really, it's at the heart of the stack sats and stay humble part of Matt O'Dell's meme, which is the humility of not wanting to indulge in materialism and finding other ways to be happy. I think that that helps with avoiding the Lambo syndrome. And then the other piece of it is continuing to work, right? So not retiring is a critical part of not having to sell your Bitcoin, and finding ways to, work in a way that you love, that it doesn't feel like drudgery. So those are important. In terms of borrowing, we have to be careful because of Bitcoin's volatility, right? So, and it's also the case that you have to be careful with drawing down on your Bitcoin because of the volatility. So you don't want to be, having to spend all of your Bitcoin in a bear market because you had an unexpected medical expense like that, So there's lots of reasons to be cautious with a speculative attack, especially at a personal level. And I'd argue that it's better to let the Michael Saylors of the world, who have a limited liability legal entity that is doing the speculative attack at scale, rather than trying to leverage up your own balance sheet to the hilt and finding yourself getting liquidated in a bear market. So there's there's a spectrum of speculative attack of how leveraged are you. And there's ways to do it rather safely on a personal level. And then there's ways that are pretty reckless. So I think to not be forced to sell, we have to caution people there as well.
Yeah. And to your point about MicroStrategy and the fact that they're probably in a better position to do this since they're a corporation and have some protections that an individual does not. And to your point earlier, Alan, what you were just describing, like, do you think we're reaching a point where, particularly at the publicly traded corporate level and even privately held companies, it's becoming a fiduciary responsibility to acquire as much Bitcoin on your balance sheet and potentially prevent yourself from selling that Bitcoin by taking out US dollar denominated debt? Like, are we reaching that tipping point?
I want to say yes. I think we all agree, at least of the rationale there. I think it's tricky. I mean, this exactly goes back to, I mentioned this before in a different context, that side of the trade seems far more intrinsically uncertain. And this is one way in which it's manifested quite well, that it's highly, highly reflexive whether or not people have the attitude that would lend itself to performing the attack in that way. And what I mean by that is that we're probably all familiar with this to some extent on the personal level. It's kind of a different calculus if you're like the CFO of a publicly traded company, that if it goes wrong, it's going to be far worse for you if nobody else did it. But if many people did it, or eventually if everybody else did it, it gets less and less bad for you personally. But obviously, you know this in advance. So it's almost like, how would you describe it? I was going to say it's like a game of chicken, but it's almost like the inverse of that in a way. It's like nobody really wants to go first, but as soon as somebody does, everybody else then has to, which is maybe what makes it a bit disappointing that I think a lot of people expected this last cycle. It felt like once MicroStrategy did what they did, or even telegraphed that they were going to do what they then did, that others ought to follow. So I think that the fact that it didn't happen, that it really is, for public companies at least, it really is just MicroStrategy still. For large US public companies. We've seen one or two more popping up in the past couple of months, but they tend to be quite small. The fact that it didn't happen the way that we would have wanted to, or as quickly as we would have wanted to, is giving me a bit of pause that it's not even that I think it will take longer necessarily. It's that I'm just trying to be humble, right? I just don't know. It feels like it's inevitable. It will happen at some point. I think you just don't want to be too, you don't want to be too aggressive in your predictions, which is probably just wise for anything to do with Bitcoin's price, I guess.
Yeah, perhaps the imitators will really jump in when the results are there that are undeniable. I would argue that the results are already undeniable, that MicroStrategy's market cap has tremendously grown. The shareholders, the employees, everyone has benefited. But, you know, when Bitcoin continues to rip, that'll really put the nail in it. And now the other part of it, I think, that is underexplored in the piece is speculative defense. So I outline two ways that there's a possibility of defending the currency, which is one, raising interest rates. And they have raised interest rates, but not nearly enough to counteract Bitcoin's CAGR, right? Its average returns are still far greater than 7% or whatever the interest rate currently is. But that has been effective for other asset classes, right? So in Austin, we're already seeing real estate prices starting to come down. So raising interest rates is effective as long as the expected return of the asset is lower than where interest rates go. But the other part of it that it is the capital controls. And this is really what Saab 121 was about, is how do we limit how much debt can be created to buy Bitcoin? And that, it seems like they're going to have a tough time in the United States implementing capital controls in sustainably. They've been able to do it in the short term by violating the Constitution. And we're seeing Coinbase actually just announced that they are suing the FDIC and the SEC over these stealth capital controls that are about debanking the Bitcoin economy to prevent speculative attacks through that vector. But that'll fall apart. And what I think, though, the third prong of a speculative defense would be simply to buy Bitcoin. It really is about capitulating and backing the currency by buying Bitcoin, much in the way that MicroStrategy is backing the shares by diluting the shareholders to buy more Bitcoin. And that could very well be a highly effective way of defending a currency, is dilute the currency by buying more Bitcoin or to buy more Bitcoin. And the net effect is actually to strengthen the currency. It's not to weaken it, because you've improved the balance sheet of the currency issuer. So that, I think, will be a trend that, El Salvador can't do it because El Salvador does not have its own currency. But Argentina could do it, although it seems like Milei is too orthodox to adopt that approach. Perhaps we'll see Trump be persuaded to do it. But again, there's lots of education to be done, and I think we'll be surprised when it does happen that, it's not who we expect to do it, but it is inevitable, I believe. Mm.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, it is this really odd mix of, on the one hand, it being very difficult to predict basically impossible to predict the timing of any of this, but also, exactly as Pierre says, it just feeling completely inevitable in the longer and longer run. I think I won't just repeat everything Pierre just said, but one or two of those points are worth emphasizing around how inevitable it seems in terms of there basically being no way out to actually stop, at the very least, Bitcoin's price rising. I agree the ways of trying to defend against it are interesting, but none of them really harm Bitcoin in any way. And again, I think in the longer and longer run, they obviously benefit Bitcoin, right? So the third one that Pierre mentioned, if they just put Bitcoin on their own balance sheet, then obviously that's buying pressure. That's great. That's probably the most straightforward one. Pierre's first point, though, around raising interest rates, I think that's quite kind of exciting or always tantalizing in a way that is pointing to something I mentioned an answer or two ago around the dollar shorts that are just waiting to implode. So you could easily imagine if this really gets going and there needs to be a public policy level defense against it, hiking interest rates in such a way that just causes widespread bank failures. And then everybody thinks, oh shit, like what even is a dollar? I need Bitcoin now. So it's fun thinking all this through. I mean, again, it's kind of scary. It depends on your exposure, I suppose. But for us, it's fun. For people listening to this, it's fun.
Well, Pierre's dealing with something. He's still there. But to your point, Alan, I mean, one of the big theses right now is that we're going to have 1970s like waves of inflation. We're in the middle of the first and second wave. And the idea is that if the Fed brings rates down again, that'll bring inflation roaring back. And then will they need to have, will they need to basically jack rates up even higher than they have right now? Can they even do that without creating the bank failures that you described? And if you couple that with what we discussed earlier, which is a falling demand for the treasuries, which is what really drives the federal government and the Fed's ability to bail out or facilitate the financial system. I know we've been saying you can't predict the timing, but it seems like, again, moving into season two, chapter two, whatever you want to call it, the coalition of events and macroeconomic factors as we head into the second half of 2024 are really interesting. Like if we get echo inflation, lack of demand for treasuries, it's like, what does the Fed and the US government do?
Yeah, I think I've said this on TFTC before, by the way, so I won't spend too much time on this, but what all of this makes me think, like what kind of instinctively comes to me even more so than, I don't know, intellectually, is basically just like, thank goodness for Bitcoin. Like, but or more specifically though, that Bitcoin's mere existence gives an excellent reason to not have to think about this too hard, or rather that maybe more in keeping with exactly how this conversation has gone, if you do think about it, it can be fun, right? Rather, it can be intellectually interesting rather than just terrifying. And I have thought about this before too, that it must have just been so depressing thinking about this stuff, I don't know, more than 15 years ago, right? Like if you were, let's say, educated enough or probably contrarian enough, more to the point, to have all of the concerns that we are discussing now, again, other than Bitcoin, you're purely the short side of all of this, concerns about the fiat system. You could have exactly the same conversation, but the tone would just be completely, completely different. It would be utterly terrifying. And your, I guess one way of thinking about it, your avenues for speculative attack would be significantly worse and riskier in and of themselves. So yeah, I'm glad I basically don't need to take this too seriously. I can just, this entire conversation can basically just be sport. That's great.
It's great for us, but that's, yeah. This gets into another interesting part of the speculative attack is the public and governments at large getting the causality wrong. And pointing the finger at Bitcoiners and saying, mm-hmm. you destroyed all these currencies by doing what you did. But I think we would all argue Bitcoiners are simply making the rational decision that they notice what the governments are doing to their currencies. They see Bitcoin juxtaposed to that and they say, I'm going to adopt the better currency. But if a speculative attack is successful and a lot of people are left on the sidelines, that is something we have to deal with. And again, going back to education, how do we communicate this to people?
Well, if people have lots of Bitcoin exposure, even indirectly by holding S&P 500 that has, you know, MicroStrategy in it, then, you know, it Bitcoin would actually be pretty widely distributed. And so it wouldn't really be hugely disruptive. Hopefully, I think the best way to get it the most widely distributed, again, is to have governments buying Bitcoin by printing more money. And that is how you get Bitcoin into the most hands, even though it goes completely counter to the purest kind of, you know, Satoshi white paper, anarcho cypherpunk ethos. Pragmatically, it's how you defuse the bomb. It's how you make this not be an issue for the wider public, where to them it's more of like an upgrade rather than some kind of catastrophe. So hopefully that's the approach that policymakers take. But that I think that it also depends on the government approach, which is it democratic government or is it authoritarian government? In a democratic government, you know, Bitcoin is popular. And so people will vote for politicians that want to adopt Bitcoin. And that helps things be orderly in transitioning to a post-fiat economy. But in authoritarian or regimes where they're only nominally democratic, but in reality, you know, they are authoritarian, then that will cause a delay in adopting Bitcoin that could cause a lot of no-coiners to be very disgruntled. And so I think that is a very real risk. And I think that it also shows why Bitcoiners should be involved in politics, because ultimately we want governments to make this a soft landing rather than creating all sorts of, you know, poverty or unnecessary harm for people.
German and U.S. governments this week, though, dumping all their Bitcoin. You hate to see it.
It's awful. It's really, to me, it's the worst policy move of the Biden administration. It eclipses even, you know, the SEC or the Department of Energy coming after Bitcoin miners. All of those things are, they're almost cosmetic, right? Theatrics. But selling Bitcoin that were seized, it's wrong on two levels. One, it's wrong on the financial level of, okay, they should be holding the Bitcoin because they can print dollars. So there's no reason to be buying dollars on the market. But two, on the moral level of, well, what if the asset forfeiture gets reversed? What if a court says, actually, you have to give the Bitcoin to so-and-so? And so then the government would have to go out and buy the Bitcoin, which, you know, or they would have to pay the person in some kind of dollar amount that is not reflective of the Bitcoin's value. So even for people who say, oh, the government should not seize Bitcoin, and therefore the government should sell seized Bitcoin, that's illogical. Because if you think the government should not seize Bitcoin, then you should also believe that the government should return the seized Bitcoin, not sell it. And so at the very least, they should hold it until they're in a position to return it. It's a policy decision that in many ways will be irreversible. So as Bitcoin's value increases, and that really is unforgivable. But we'll see if the next administration has a wiser approach to it.
And I'm not sure exactly which portion of the seized Bitcoin they're selling this week. I forget from which asset seizure it is, but I think in the case of Bitfinex, where the U.S. government seized Bitcoin from the person that stole Bitcoin from the exchange, like Bitfinex should get their Bitcoin back if we live in a just society.
I think they did, but I don't know about the specific details. I thought the coins they were selling was related to Silk Road still, but
still Silk Road, yeah. Yeah, I want to be clear. I don't know if they're selling Bitfinex's coins, but they're still holding them. They should give them back to Bitfinex.
They should.
Yeah. It's And how much is, what would you guys put the likely, obviously we have El Salvador, we're seeing these movements of the BRICS countries diversifying away from treasuries. We've seen China buy a lot of gold. What, I mean, El Salvador, again, obviously a big moment in Bitcoin, country making it legal tender, staying humble and stacking sats month in and month out. But what do you think it would do to accelerate the speculative attack if one of the bigger nations got in? And what would the two of you put the likelihood of a larger nation outside the U.S. getting into Bitcoin going into the next 2-3 years?
Yeah, I think that it may be driven through the Bitcoin mining industry, that nations that are abundant in energy, you know, at first it's the private sector that's mining Bitcoin. And then you have a politician say, oh, we should mine all of the Bitcoin here. And then they realize that would be very expensive relative to buying Bitcoin. And so that's how you would end up kind of walking through the maze to end up buying Bitcoin is from the energy angle. Obviously, the Middle East stands out in its energy abundance, but there's lots of other places around the world. I think that's the highest probability, but I still think that's low probability compared to El Salvador continuing to be the standout, just like MicroStrategy is the standout, and that El Salvador could attract a tremendous amount of economic activity. You had Kathy Wood saying they're going to 10x their GDP. And so really it might end up being that MicroStrategy and El Salvador continue to grow rather than other competitors trying to imitate them in the short run, at least.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think mining is the most obvious first step for nation state. I'm not even sure I call it adoption necessarily, involvement, nation state involvement. The one thing I'd add to Pierre's comments though is that I think this isn't really addressing your question, Marty. Sorry, I'm not sure how likely I think this is. It's more just whenever this does happen, I think it will be kept secret for a long time, for basically as long as whoever's doing it can get away with it. So it could be that it's happening now. Maybe that kind of answers the question a little bit. It could be happening right now and we won't know for several years.
And we purely we have had recent I was gonna say we have had recent confirmation of the strategy you're describing with the Kingdom of Bhutan, which has been which was quietly accumulating Bitcoin since early 2020, but due to the fact that they got swept up in some bankruptcy proceedings, it was
I don't know the details there all that much, but that's
You didn't know that so the Kingdom of Bhutan had to come out and admit, like, yes, we've been mining Bitcoin and accumulating Bitcoin.
I knew they admitted it. I didn't know why.
Because they got caught up in the Celsius and BlockFi bankruptcy proceedings, and so it got made public that they were doing this.
That's unfortunate for them, I guess. Well, but then that's even back to, like, they need education, right? Like, they, I told you, they're going to get wrecked. They're going to learn by getting wrecked, and they should have just gone on Nakamoto Institute from day one. But yeah, I think we'll see a lot more of that. And to try to bring it back to your question again, without, because I have no idea on probability. Sorry, that's kind of my answer to all this. Is like, that's it's also what makes it exciting. I just absolutely have no idea, except that it gets more likely in the longer and longer run. But the rationale for keeping it secret, I think that's the most interesting part, because it's basically you want to front run people as much as possible, right? It's in, and again, we have experience of this from the individual level, that the incentives are not exactly the same, but they're similar enough to recognize that the longer the price stays down, or, you know, relative to not at any absolute level, but just less than like shooting up when you're still trying to buy, the better that is for you. If you know that, I guess on the one hand, at the individual level, what's more relatable is, you know, you have a fiat salary, so you know what your buying schedule is going to be. With mining, it's maybe even more straightforward. Is that, like, you know, you obviously can't, it's physics. You can't accelerate that. You've got to actually do the work over time. So if you just do it secretly for as long as possible, then that's great. Maybe borrow in dollars to fund it as well, just to round out the link here.
Well, I've had that idea for quite a while, is Bitcoin mining permanent funds, where whether at the state level
or the municipality level, you issue muni bonds to raise cash to acquire energy assets or ASICs, and then roll the revenue into a Bitcoin permanent fund, pay off the bondholders, and then just keep rolling the revenue, rinse and repeat. Speculative attack fee.
Which, so that's super interesting. I think I want Pierre's comment on this as well, but my interpretation of that is it's in the spirit of what Pierre's described earlier of actually the best way to fend this off is just for states to buy Bitcoin themselves. But it's not quite as clean as what Pierre was putting forward. And in fact, is more in keeping with what we're describing in terms of the avenues for attack widening, because it's channeling it through the excesses in capital markets, right? The involuntary shorts that are looking for a long. Well, the long is, I mean, it's mining, I guess, but that's obviously just a proxy for eventual Bitcoin.
Yeah, the limiting factor there is access to energy at what price. And so when we look at El Salvador, for example, electricity is relatively expensive in El Salvador, despite the geothermal that is developed there. And so for them, it really does make sense to just go out and buy the Bitcoin. The suggestion I'd have for President Bukele would be to issue more bonds and to further indebt the country to buy more Bitcoin. But ultimately he rules by democratic legitimacy. And so perhaps his people would not, want that. They don't want the country to be over leveraged. But I think that would be a wise move, even though, I'm sure he's got other priorities going on as well.
Well, there's a natural and almost cute, in a way, counter to the question of the democratic accountability that you obviously have to keep in the back of your mind, that I think that actually that strategy lends itself to, what's the best way of putting this? Normalizing the argument that it is, in fact, responsible, that if anything, you potentially have a fiduciary responsibility to do this kind of thing, because as we know, I mean, this is like half a sentence or something in the newer piece, but since they've done this, their bonds have been like unbelievable performers, again, within the scheme of how well an emerging market bond can perform. But it's just really interesting. Again, this avenue of tapping all these excesses in capital markets, becoming self-fulfilling, and probably in the longer and longer run, lending itself to not only making your own individual trade or country's trade, I guess, not like Bukele's personal trade, but that trade looking more responsible, but normalizing the idea of that trade being responsible. That's also really fun to see playing out.
Yeah. Go ahead, Pierre. Look, yeah. I'm sending it.
Well, so I was thinking about, with one of the advantages that Saylor has is that he can issue a convertible bond that converts into equity that a sovereign does not have. Now, maybe, though, there'd be a way for Bukele to develop some equity in the government of El Salvador, which, really becomes very, very colonial very quick. But the other option is really looking at it from the perspective of what other ways are there of securing the bond. And so it might just be a question of him having a credible way of custodying the Bitcoin where it's still transparent, but it would give the creditor some level of confidence that there's some recourse if things go south, if somebody else gets elected in El Salvador, that they would still get repaid using the Bitcoin as collateral. And so, hopefully that's something on his radar.
I might be misremembering this. Maybe one of you two can fill in this gap, but I swear I have actually heard a proposal like this. Maybe it just wasn't entirely serious, I guess, from the government of El Salvador, but they would have a bond which was in part, and it's basically approximating a convertible into equity as best you can with a country where what it converts into is some proportion of the Bitcoin's appreciation. Does this sound familiar? I'm pretty sure I'm not making this up. I have heard something like this before.
Yeah, I think though that it was structured in a way that was like too creative in a sense. Right. And so, because if you're trying to tap into the excesses of the bond market, you have to have something that's pretty vanilla that, you know, a bond portfolio yeah. manager could just buy without getting a lot of scrutiny. And so I also am not familiar with the details of their IMF negotiations. So perhaps they've got other limitations that, you know, are more opaque.
Would be a smart move though. And we're seeing, strategies like that at the individual layer. Like we've got companies in our portfolio at 1031 that want to restructure, traditional credit products or the commercial real estate, energy, and dual collateralize with the asset, whether it's the commercial real estate property or the energy asset and Bitcoin, and have the lender and the borrower participate in the appreciation of the Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. That in my way, this is an incredible vehicle to manifest the soft landing that Jerome Powell, Janet Yellen, and everybody in the government would like to see happen. But you're really not going to do it without restructuring a lot of the credit, the debt that exists out there, dual collateralizing with Bitcoin and the other underlying assets, in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great example of, again, something I mentioned earlier. I was thinking the example that came to mind for me was the kind of pseudo credit card one, but yeah, I'm familiar with exactly what you're talking about, Marty, that, again, interestingly, this is relatively new, right? You need quite a lot of infrastructure built out to facilitate these kinds of financial products. But I guess underlying all of it is number go up, creating a pretty obvious incentive to try to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know we're coming up on time here, but I was on my phone because I was sending Logan this tweet and bringing it back to the individual level, the level of the individual and driving urgency for them to understand that they should be speculative attacking the dollar. The government lies about inflation statistics and data. And so they'll tell you that inflation has been tamed and they'll tell you not to believe your lying eyes and try to quell you into a sedative state where you don't act to protect your wealth by accumulating Bitcoin. And we had a great example of that on Twitter yesterday. This gentleman went to reorder something on Walmart that he ordered 2 years ago. And he came to find that the price of his basket of goods that he bought from Walmart tripled in just 2 years. Let me play this.
I feel like I'm going to be sick. I just like looked through my Walmart history and I found this like Walmart order from 2 years ago for the whole month worth of groceries. 45 items cost $126. A whole month of groceries just for me, basically. But I did notice this reorder all button, and I wanted to see how much it would cost now. Now, this order of 45 items for 1 month would have cost $414. That is four times more. How the fuck... How? Like, what?
So the government would lead you to believe that inflation is not 329% over the last 2 years, but this Walmart basket of goods, that's a pretty diverse basket of goods, 53 items.
I'm kind of straining this interpretation, but I think the comic effect is worth it. That's him getting wrecked, right? That's what you're watching there. He's long dollar. And you're watching him realize how wrecked he is. So get him on Nakamoto Institute as well. That would be by far the most helpful comment that could be left on that TikTok.
Well, if you were to price that basket of goods in Bitcoin, it would be worth less sats today.
Yeah.
There was an interview with Janet Yellen where the interviewer asked her if she had sticker shock going to the supermarket. And her response was no. So they're very dishonest. I mean, or she's senile. It's like, which one is it? And I think that the level of denial will continue. They clearly, to them, it's enough to say, oh, well, we got inflation back to 2%. but people are going to continue to have the reaction that that guy had of, wait, hold on. Even if inflation today is actually 2%, nevertheless, over the past 5 years, you know, it's 400%. So it's an arbitrary time frame to say, oh, only annualized CPI is relevant. People have longer memories than that, right? People have memories going back decades. So you're essentially attacking people's memories and trying to gaslight them into thinking that this is okay. But really, they've stolen a tremendous amount of wealth and redistributed it in a way that there will never be accountability for.
No, it is your duty as an individual to protect yourself, your family, your business from this overt theft via inflation. And again, they're literally telling us not to believe our lying eyes. It's only 3% inflation. It's not 329%.
Walmart. It's becoming so blatant that I feel like we might be there already, but we're certainly pretty close to the narrative switching to, okay, there is inflation and it's a good thing. And like, here's all the reasons why you should be really happy about this.
I recorded
with Peter. Kind of always been the fiat or, you know, mainstream economics argument anyway, but I think it'll be quite entertaining watching them try to popularize that beyond the academy, let's say, beyond the kind of thing that we make fun of on Bitcoin Twitter and actually become something normal people talk about.
Well, I think despite how they try to frame it, like, all right, there's no inflation, to inflation good. What really matters is how people act, like this gentleman, like freaking out that the basket of goods went up significantly. And I had a discussion with Peter St. Andre earlier this week, and he said something that I never heard and was interesting and makes sense to me. He said there are accounting bodies that define hyperinflation as 20%. Many economists will say it has to be over 50 or some astronomically high number in the thousands of percent per year. But this accounting board has essentially identified 20% as the level at which people will act differently once dollars hit their bank account when they get paid. They'll go and they'll buy goods right away. They'll do something that they otherwise would not have if they weren't aware of the high rates of inflation. So again, going back to the government's telling you not to believe your lying eyes and is misreporting the amount of inflation, like that is something that people listening to this episode, particularly under the context of speculative attack and how you should approach your Bitcoin accumulation strategy and basically benchmarking it to what's happening in the fiat world. Like annualized over the last 4 years, real inflation is likely over 15-20%. And is that, like, are we living to the beginning of a hyperinflationary event here in the United States, potentially? Especially if we have 1970s like echo inflation on the back end of this decade. And so seriously consider the ideas put forth in the original speculative attack and the follow up decade later version that Alan and Pierre have written. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you think the freak should be aware of?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground today.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, it's always a pleasure. Pierre, you are humble. You are modest. Don't want to blow smoke up your ass, but I'm about to. One of my favorite pieces, one of the most formative pieces I read in the early days, and still go back and reread year in and year out and send to people. Like you said earlier, Alan, short, but gets right to the point. And I was, and still am, left side of the bell curve. I was like, oh, this is how it's going to happen. And despite the fact it may not be happening as quickly as we all imagined a decade ago, I think it certainly is happening to some degree. And I do think it will accelerate and is in the process of accelerating right now. Like I said, the timing of the 10-year anniversary and the follow-up piece that you two wrote, I think, could be more prescient with everything that's going on in the world of fiat.
Let's do this again in 10 years.
Yeah. Season 3.
Season 3. Gosh.
Just one
final thing. Teenagers at that point, which is weird.
Marty, you're obviously mentioning you go back and reread it and you go and send it to people. I'm not sure if I even told Pierre this. Maybe I did right at the start when I first pitched it to him. But for me, literally the idea that we should write this and that we should update it was me rereading the original and realizing, holy crap, that was nearly 10 years ago. Like the actual 10-year anniversary is coming up. That would be cool. And then it kind of snowballed from there. Like, it'd be cool if we, you know, if we did an update, blah, blah, blah. But that, yeah, that in itself, I think is the best testament of all that, you know, I only realized that in the first place because every now and then I go back and read it. Probably done that going on 10 times, I would say.
And I'm very grateful, Alan, that you reached out because I always felt like there needed to be an update to it, especially after we saw Michael Saylor with his spin on a speculative attack. And so now that is accomplished and in a very timely manner.
Go forth and speculative attack the dollar. Stay humble, yeah. Stack sats, peace and love, freaks.